Now here is Bill Resnick and Phyllis Bennis.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome to KABU.
Great to be back with you.
Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at Institute for Policy Studies. She's a writer, an activist, an analyst on Middle East and UN issues. She speaks widely across the U.S. and around the world as part of the global peace movement. Her 11 books include Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, also U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terror, and also Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. We certainly need that now. She continuously updates us with short pieces on the Institute for Policy Studies website and the New Internationalism newsletter. You can find both of them at the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis Bennis, you recently wrote about the under-the-radar gathering, a meeting with the United States, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and autocratic Gulf states. It was at the White House. It appears to have set the stage for a very aggressive U.S. campaign against Iran, including the use of military power, which will surely further inflame the region and draw in many, many other countries. It's likely to heat up soon with the U.S. pulling out of an international nuclear arms deal with Iran. It's a very complicated story with so many actors whose behavior is hard to predict, but alarming. So, Phyllis Bennis, what's happening? Why are the Trumpites targeting Iran now?
Well, the Trump administration is hardly the first U.S. administration to target Iran. Iran has been in the U.S. crosshairs for a couple of decades now. Iran is not, contrary to a lot of propaganda, an existential threat to Israel, certainly is not an existential threat to the United States. What Iran is a challenge to U.S. and U.S. proxies' efforts to be the regional dominant power in the Middle East. So there's a long-standing competition that's underway between Iran and Saudi Arabia for who's going to be the leading regional power. Militarily, of course, Israel is by far the most powerful component in the region, but it doesn't have the other components you need to be a regional. You need basically three things. You need size of land and population. You need wealth, usually from oil, and you need water. And historically, the only two countries in the Middle East that had all those three things were Iran and Iraq. The U.S. took Iraq out of the equation by 12 years of crippling sanctions and by its invasions and destruction and overthrow of the government. So then you had Iran emerging, and the new challenge initially came from Turkey for a brief period, but right now it's really Saudi Arabia that is the main challenger to Iran as the regional hegemon. And Iran's regional influence is far less military. There is military influence of Iran in a number of countries, but it's far more in the economic, trade, cultural arena. There's also, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's a long-standing sectarian battle as well. They represent two different strands of political versions of Islam. Saudi Arabia, of course, is run by very extremist versions of Sunni Islam, Iran by the Shia version of Islam. And that kind of sectarian divide between Sunni and Shia is a component. It's not the most important. It's not the strategic interests that have to do with trade and military power and access to water and all those things, but it is a factor in that competition. And you see that competition these days playing out with horrible consequences in places like Syria, where Iran and Saudi Arabia are waging war with Syrians doing the dying. You see it in Yemen with horrific consequences, where the long-running, decades-long civil conflict inside Yemen, which had never taken the form of a full-scale civil war, erupted into full-scale war on one side when Saudi Arabia decided to launch military assaults against Yemen in 2015, claiming that it was trying to reinstate the ousted former leader, but in fact doing it because the rebel forces, known as the Houthis in Yemen, who had been fighting against the Yemeni government for a long, long time, were allied in some generic sense with Iran. They weren't very close to Iran. They weren't getting a lot of support from Iran. They were getting a little bit of support. But the Saudis decided that was unacceptable, and they went in on a massive bombing campaign, a huge effort to isolate Yemen and cut off its access to shipping, so that a huge famine has erupted. 10,000 or more people have been killed in the bombing raids, and these are carried out by Saudi Arabia, the key U.S. Arab ally, with the direct and indirect support of the United States. So on the indirect side, of course, you have the Saudis buying tens of billions of dollars worth every year of the most advanced U.S. weapons. These are U.S. bombers, U.S. bombs that the Saudis are dropping on Yemeni civilians.
Yeah. I understand it's $5 billion a month costing the Saudis to buy all that equipment from the U.S. It's a bonanza for the U.S. arms industry.
It's a huge bonanza, and it's something that is very close to the Trump administration's heart. We should note that much of this, however, began under President Obama, who orchestrated a $60 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia, what was then the largest arms deal in history. It's now been surpassed by newer arms deals. But the other thing that's important to recognize here is that it's not only the arms sales, it's direct involvement of the U.S. military. There are U.S. pilots flying U.S. Air Force planes along with the Saudi bombers, which, of course, were purchased from the U.S., who are doing the mid-air refueling so that they can be much more efficient in their bombing raids. So this is a U.S. direct responsibility for these.
They also, U.S. surveillance planes and drones and satellites are also surveilling Yemen and finding targets. There aren't any targets. They're just killing civilians. Israel seems to me also part of that equation. My sense is it's like the Iraq War, where the leadership of the U.S., a sort of poorly qualified guys like Cheney and Rumsfeld with right-wing aspirations and glorying in war, like our cadet bone spurs, Trump, they really think they can win big battles. But the Israelis then fill them with propaganda that if only they get rid of this one power, it was Iraq back then, now it's Iran, then, in fact, they can take over the Middle East and it will become a sort of a paradise of free market capitalism and support for the U.S. as well as cheap oil.
The irony is that the Middle East today is, in fact, a bonanza for crony capitalism. You know, there's no socialist challenge to U.S.-dominated capitalism around the Middle East. The Israelis, I have a slightly different take. I think the Israelis were not the major force in pushing for war in Iraq. They wanted to go to war against Iran even back then. They jumped on the Iraq war bandwagon when it became clear that that was the first major target. Afghanistan didn't count in this sense. Iraq was going to be the first major regional target, and Israel certainly never saw the overthrow of an Arab regime that they didn't want to happen, so they jumped on that bandwagon. But they were not the main force pushing for war in Iraq. They wanted war directly against Iran then, and they want it now. And one of the key leaders of that period has just been appointed, as everybody knows, to be the new National Security Advisor, and that's John Bolton, who was one of the leading anti-Iran, bomb Iran voices, as well as a leading bomb Iraq voice back in the 1990s and into the period right after 9/11. He played a major role in orchestrating how the U.S. would go about initiating its war against Iraq. He was, for a brief time, when he was the, ironically, Undersecretary of State for Disarmament Affairs, one of his big claims to fame later was that he orchestrated the ouster of the chief of the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, a noted Brazilian diplomat named José Bustani. And when he went to Bustani's office and said, "You've got 24 hours to resign." Why? Because Bustani was in the process of negotiating. This was in 2002 when tensions with Iraq were at their highest. U.S. war was looming, but there was still hope it could be somehow prevented. Bustani went to the Saddam Hussein regime and said, "You should join the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons." And the word was at that time that Saddam Hussein was prepared to do that. If he had done that, if he had signed on to join that organization, it would have required incredibly intrusive inspections across the country to certify Iraq's entrance to that organization. If that happened, it was clear in Washington that their false claims about Iraq supposedly having these so-called weapons of mass destruction, including chemical weapons, would be proved to be lies. They didn't want that to happen. So Bolton was given the task, or took the task, it's not clear, to get rid of the leadership of that organization, to undermine that effort. He goes to Bustani and says, you've got 24 hours to resign. Bustani says, I will not. I've been reelected by the 145 nation states of this organization to be the director, and I'm keeping my job. And within just a few weeks, Bolton organized a vote and got enough votes through bribes and threats and punishments, the usual version of U.S. diplomacy, to vote him out. And so that was the end of the effort to have Iraq join the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. So there's a long history that Bolton has directly, both in Iraq and Iran. And, of course, lately he's called directly for a first strike against North Korea. This is somebody who clearly disdains diplomacy and wants to move directly to war as the first response to any international crisis.
And he doesn't have to be even confirmed by the Senate.
Right. This is quite dangerous. It's not a confirmable position. So he just gets to start the day that Trump says he starts, which I think is April 9th. It's going to be a very, very dangerous, very frightening period because he's a man with no understanding of what war means in the countries where it's fought, no concern. He's not stupid, so I won't say he doesn't understand. I will say there's no evidence that he has any concern about what wars lead to, how wars spin out of control. You could say, well, Trump probably doesn't want to send ground troops, for instance, to Iran if there were to be an attack on Iran. That's probably true. But whether he gets to make that judgment call once the war has started and has escalated in ways that he could not predict is a whole different matter.
Yeah, their whole reputations. Once they begin the war, their whole lives become, and especially Trump, he doesn't want to be a loser. He will do anything. Lying is a small part of it, cheating, to be able to call himself a winner. It seems very, very dangerous, the character of these guys and the ignorance. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU Radio, talking to Phyllis Bennis of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She does a lot of writing and speaking and activism within the peace movement and to try and stop the Israelis, Saudi Arabians, and U.S. efforts to dominate the Middle East. Phyllis Bennis, let's discuss what happens if Trump pulls out. There's every sign that he's going to pull out the deal with Iran and then starts making demands and threats and, who knows, provocations against Iran, which they may respond to. Tell us about what Iran could do. Tell us about what's happening in Europe and Russia and China.
Well, we don't know yet exactly what Trump is going to do on May 12th. That's the day that he has to certify whether or not to reimpose nuclear-related sanctions on Iran. That was the agreement the U.S. made when it signed the Iran nuclear deal, was to end the nuclear-related sanctions. The U.S., of course, is still imposing massive other sanctions on Iran. Those are continuing anyway. But the nuclear-related sanctions were to be lifted. The threat, of course, is that this time around, and Trump has indicated this, and certainly John Bolton would support the idea of ending that waiver and saying, nope, we're putting those nuclear sanctions back into play. At that point, Iran could say, well, that's fine. The U.S. is going to do what it's going to do. We are going to maintain our position implementing the terms of the agreement because we believe it's the right thing to do. That could certainly happen. On the other hand, there are hardline forces in Iran who may see this as an opportunity to shift that perspective and say, you see, because the U.S. can't be trusted, there's no way that we can maintain this agreement with the other five members that we signed with, those being European countries, Russia, and China. And we're going to go back to what we agreed to stop, which was enriching uranium for research and nuclear power. We're going to go back to enriching uranium. We're going to rebuild those machineries that we had either destroyed or put in storage to prevent us from continuing to enrich uranium. We're going to start doing that again. That, for the U.S., for some, they would say, well, that's evidence that Iran is now again trying to build a nuclear weapon, despite the fact that there was no nuclear weapons program, according to all 17 of the U.S. intelligence agencies back in 2003. So it's a very dangerous moment. if the Trump administration goes that route, it will open up a whole set of dangerous possibilities. The Europeans have not figured out a unified position yet of what they will do. The Trump administration has demanded that Europe take some new initiatives as the only way that they would agree to continue their role in the Iran nuclear deal. They've said that if Europe would demand changes to the deal and or add additional conditions, that they would agree to stay. But the problem is the deal is already a done deal. You can't go back and renegotiate it, reopen it, and assume that the Iranians are going to agree to these new, very stringent demands. So that's really not an option. The Israelis, of course, have been pushing. Netanyahu has made his political career over the last decade and a half or so at being the Israeli voice demanding of the U.S. that it not sign the nuclear deal, that it not implement the nuclear deal, and that now that it's in the nuclear deal, that it get rid of the nuclear deal. So that's been a longstanding Israeli position. Less visibly, but just as passionately, Saudi Arabia has taken that position as well. And the new crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, who has become the BFF of Jared Kushner, the two of them, the crown princes, if you will, of Saudi Arabia and the United States, have put together what I believe to be a very dangerous kind of united front against Iran. All of this makes the May 12th deadline very, very critical. This leads to the question of what do we do about all this? I think what we do is keep the pressure on Congress. The White House may or may not be vulnerable at all to public pressure. There's no indication that it is. But Congress has to play a role here as well in terms of how it will take up the question of the Iran nuclear deal, what it will do in response. In the meantime, there are moves in Congress to stop the U.S. involvement in Yemen, to stop the U.S. support for the Saudi war against civilians in Yemen. There was a vote just this past week that came very, very tantalizingly close to winning. It was a vote that ultimately lost. 55 members voted to continue the war. 44 members of the Senate voted to move forward with a final decision that could lead to stopping U.S. support for the war. It was very close, and it indicates that the support for Saudi Arabia in the Senate, as well as in the House, is diminishing. So there needs to be continued pressure on Congress to stop the U.S. support for the war in Yemen. This is what the U.N. has called the worst humanitarian catastrophe going on in the world today.
Israel is very likely, though, to pull out all the stops to make sure that doesn't happen in Congress, it seems to me.
Well, Israel doesn't really have to on this one. Israel, I'm sure, supports the idea of continuing the war, but the Saudis have pulled out all their stops. And on this one, they are far more visibly committed. This is really a Saudi initiative. This has everything to do with MBS's trip to the U.S. He's in the U.S. right now. He's going to be coming to California in the next couple of days. He's been up at MIT. He's been in New York. He's meeting with Silicon Valley. He's being feted in the pages of the New York Times as this great reformer. He's going to, wait for it, allow women to drive, despite the fact that women are still required to have a so-called guardian before they can apply for a passport, et cetera.
He's on a charm offensive in the West.
His main point is that he is leading a war against civilians in Yemen that has been responsible for the deaths of thousands. So that's the key thing about the Saudis right now. But there is a chance to stop this. There is no authorization, none of the earlier authorizations for the use of military force in any interpretation can be used to authorize the use of military force in Yemen. The authorization for force of 2001, which was designed to respond to the attacks of 9/11, was very specific. It was to be used against those who carried out the attacks of 9/11 and those who harbored them. That meant the Al-Qaeda, who carried them out, and the Taliban, who supported them. In Yemen, Al-Qaeda is gaining from the U.S. role. Al-Qaeda is on the same side as the Saudis in Yemen. So it simply doesn't work. There is no authority, and it's up to Congress to say the Constitution says only Congress can declare war. They are waging war illegally, and Congress needs to call them to account. There is the indication now that that could happen.
It seems to me that's a long shot, But in fact, it becomes much more likely if the U.S. peace movement really revives, if the march coming up in Washington, D.C. and many other places to coincide with Trump's vainglorious, absurd war march. I believe it's on November 14th.
I think there will be protests against the parade. It's seen as a travesty. It's a waste of money. It's all those things, and there's lots of opposition to it. But beyond the marches, between now and then, this is a huge opportunity to bring the issues of the cost of war, how the fact that 54 cents out of every federal dollar goes to the military, and that's the biggest single reason why we don't have enough money for health care and education and jobs and infrastructure, more than anything else. That fact and the moral question, remembering Dr. Martin Luther King 50 years ago, reminding us that militarism is tied to poverty and racism and that you can't fight one without the other. It's not just about the peace movement coming back and going into the streets. It's about bringing the issues of war, the issues of militarism of our communities, how the militarization of police is tied to the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. All of these things are linked. Bringing those to the other movements that are on the rise so powerfully. This past weekend, when you had these incredible, inspiring protests all around the country, all around the world, 800-plus marches for our lives, marches against gun violence, not only mass shooters in schools, but the violence of police against young black people in communities across this country. When those police forces are armed with military weapons provided by the Pentagon, we need to be bringing to that movement, to the Black Lives Matter movement, to the immigrant rights movement, to the We Too movement, all of the movements that are rising today are tied to the question of militarism. And this is an incredible opportunity, using this issue of this insane parade idea, to bring that to these movements and do the kind of education that we haven't done enough of about what militarism looks like in this country and why it is dangerous for all of us here at home as well as internationally.
Phyllis Bennis, thanks a lot for talking. The next several months, we have time to really work intensively on this question, linking all of the movements. You said it so well. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
All right. So long.